From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Obamacare enrollment numbers for Texas are announced. How did we do? The Supreme Court rules against Texas in a battle over clean air. And an execution in Oklahoma is poorly executed. What does this mean for the death penalty in Texas? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Nationwide, over 8 million people signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and that's a number that surpassed the goal for the Obama administration in their signature program. And in Texas, new numbers show that over 730,000 people signed up. Before the Obamacare rollout, it was estimated that 6 million Texans are uninsured and that the state has the highest percentage of uninsured. Stacy Pogue is a senior policy analyst with the Austin-based Center for Public Policy Priorities.
So what we learned today is the number of Texans who have selected a private health insurance plan in the brand new marketplace. And about 734,000 Texans enrolled in a plan in the marketplace through mid-April.
Is that bad? Is that good? How did that? What were our expectations?
That's a good question, right? It's hard to evaluate. Many states that had really embraced the Affordable Care Act had their own state standards. We, as a state, did not. You know, this state and lots of the leadership in the state were. Certainly not actively embracing, and in some cases kind of working against, you know, enrollment in the Affordable Care Act. So we don't have a great benchmark at the state level. The one projection we have that was state-based was the Obama administration themselves had a memo that projected enrollment state by state that was back from, you know, before open enrollment started in October, and their projection for Texas was 629,000. So we exceeded by 100,000 people, you know, the one benchmark we have that was a state-based or state a number projected for our state.
Texas has been known as the state with the most uninsured people. Where does this leave us now?
California enrollment in their marketplace was 1.4 million, you know, so it's double ours. So, you know, who knows after we have all the census data reporting is out exactly where we fall out. But I think what we'll see, you know, relative to other states, I think what we'll see for Texas and have already begun to see in kind of the initial reports on the uninsured rate is that it will decline, that with 700,000 people who have new coverage in the marketplace. But on top of that, people who enrolled in private coverage outside of the marketplace, people who picked up an employer plan that they might have passed by in the past, people who keep their 26-year-olds or young adults up to age 26 on their employer-sponsored plan, and people who enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP who might have always been eligible but didn't go through the enrollment process until the message about the Affordable Care Act got out. Through all of these channels that are all linked to the Affordable Care Act, whether or not they're technically in the marketplace, we've seen, you know, Texans enrolling. So I suspect when we get census data, which we will not have for a while, you know, we will see that our uninsured rate has dropped. That will probably happen, you know, in lots of states. Whether we still end up last, you know, is not something we'll be able to answer, I think, for a long time.
So, but Texas did not get much help from Governor Perry and other leading office holders in the state of Texas. You could pretty much say they were openly hostile for the Affordable Care Act in Texas. And how did this 733,757 Texans, how did it happen then?
I think that shows an amazing need and desire for affordable and quality health insurance, even when most of the messages you're getting from leadership of your state and elected officials and sometimes through the media are messages about the offerings being bad or the program being bad. I think it really speaks volumes that this is actually a product and a program that is in demand in Texas, even a state where leadership is, again, so hostile to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And we can only guess, you know, how it would look different if our state had really embraced the Affordable Care Act. But, you know, you can see in the enrollment report, the states that have done that, California is an example, have have really incredible enrollment numbers in many of those cases.
But do we know about who were these people? Do we know what demographic they are? I mean, we fear this death spiral, and we need the younger people to have signed up.
I don't think any healthcare experts are talking about death spirals anymore. I think there was a lot of talk about that in October and November. Enrollment was low in those months because the website just simply didn't work. You know, in Texas, in those 2 months, we had 14,000 people enrolled. You know, not a lot. And so there was a lot of concern about it then. I don't think anybody in the last few months has thought seriously that the marketplaces just won't work and won't function because there's not enough enrollment. But we did learn some things in this new report about who's enrolling in Texas. There were questions in the application about race and ethnicity, and they were not mandatory. So a good share of people didn't answer them. But when you exclude the folks for whom we don't have information, we know that 34% of people who selected plans in Texas were Latino, 38% were Anglo. We know that 30% of plan selections in Texas came from young adults, so that target demographic that mattered of 18 to 34-year-olds, 30% of our plan enrollments were that age. The rate of enrollment in that age group increased as we got closer and closer to the deadline, and we ended up just slightly higher than the national average of 28% for young adult enrollment.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. The other thing I think is really meaningful when you look at these numbers is that 84% of the people who enrolled in Texas got financial help. So
that means they got the supplements.
Yep, they got financial help paying their premiums every month. That makes the coverage much more affordable. So, you know, the coverage might have been, and private coverage has historically been, out of reach financially for a lot of families that are struggling to get by. And one really important thing about the Affordable Care Act is the subsidies, the financial help that makes private health insurance available on a sliding scale to low and moderate income families. And you can see that that is an essential piece to getting people enrolled through the marketplace. 84% of the people who enrolled got help in Texas.
So, but there's still a lot of Texans left in that coverage gap. They don't qualify for Medicaid because we didn't expand Medicaid in Texas, and they didn't qualify for the Affordable Care Act. What's there for them?
Yeah, so as good as the news is for the, you know, over 700,000 people who enrolled, we've got bad news for 1 million people who are in what we call the coverage gap. People who do not qualify for subsidies in the marketplace and are very low income, they're making under $14,000 a year for an individual, and they don't qualify for Medicaid. And they won't until our state decides to accept the federal funds that are on the table to provide health insurance to that coverage gap population. And so it's at least 1 million people in Texas who are shut out of Medicaid coverage, shut out of marketplace coverage, and have no affordable options. These are working Texans. There are veterans in this group. There are lots of folks in this group that need and want access to health care and need the state to take action to make sure that they can get health insurance.
So there's nothing for them now. They have to wait until there's some sort of change in the way Texas does things.
That's correct. There's nothing for them now, and it'll take state action to ensure that they have health insurance.
Stacey Pogue is a senior policy analyst with the Austin-based Center for Public Policy Priorities. She's reacting to the release of numbers showing that over 730,000 Texans signed up for the Affordable Care Act. The next enrollment window opens November 15th. A ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday delivered a major victory for the EPA and a stinging defeat for the Texas state government. A 6-2 decision upheld the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to keep air pollution from Texas and other states from harming downwind neighbors. The decision is also a loss for Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, who had challenged the rule and is using his opposition to the EPA as a tentpole in his campaign for governor. In a statement, Abbott said the EPA's cross-state air pollution rule is a job killer in Texas, and he will continue to fight back against this unlawful and overreaching regulation. Environmentalists are celebrating the Supreme Court decision. Luke Metzger is the director for Environment Texas.
We're thrilled. It was a huge victory for clean air and affirming EPA's rule to control air pollution from power plants. So we're very excited about it.
It's pretty clear that Texas has to respond to this and other states, and there isn't a lot of wiggle room.
Yeah, the Supreme Court is the end of the line, so the you know, the legal challenges have run out. So this is, means that Texas is going to need to move forward with having our power plants clean up their act and reduce their pollution.
What did the Supreme Court actually decide? Can you break it down for the listener?
Sure. Well, so the Clean Air Act has what's known as the good neighbor policy, which says that air pollution, of course, doesn't respect state boundary lines. It can easily cross cross lines. And the good neighbor policy says that if you pollute the air of another state, you know, you need to clean up your act. Just like, you know, you can't just dump your garbage in your neighbor's backyard. You know, you have to clean that up. So the same is true with air pollution. So what this requires then is, and the Supreme Court recognized, is that because air pollution really travels around the country, a state-by-state solution won't work. You do need a federal action. That's what the EPA attempted to do. And this has been coming for really 15 years, and it's been, you know, dogged by legal challenges. So industry has known this has been coming for a long time. Some, you know, companies like NRG and Dynegy and others chose to go ahead and invest in those more modern pollution controls. And, you know, they have a leg up now over, you know, some of the other companies like Luminant, who owns some of the dirtiest power plants here in Texas, who chose not to make those investments and now are going to have to play catch up.
This was a rule that came about from the EPA, and then Texas sued them. This was one of those Greg Abbott lawsuits.
Exactly. Yeah. Attorney General Abbott has, you know, of course, famously said that his job is going to the office and suing the Barack Obama every day, and the EPA has been a main target of his lawsuits. You know, they've spent millions of dollars suing the federal government, and you know, as a result, you know, what it's meant is, you know, we think it's been a waste of money, clearly, because the Supreme Court voted overwhelmingly, 6-2, in support of this rule. And in the meantime, we've had these critical clean air protections, which are going to save, you know, more than 34,000 lives across the country every year, have been delayed. And so that's been, you know, we've been suffering for with, you know, dirty air for too long, and Attorney General Abbott has been, unfortunately, you know, stalling progress on and moving towards clean air.
Now that Texas has to follow this ruling from the EPA, the Supreme Court says this is not federal government overreach. This is proper and this is the law. What does that mean for Texas power plants? What does it mean for Texas energy consumers?
Well, power plants are going to have to, and the utilities that own them will have to find ways to reduce their pollution, and that could come through a few ways. You know, they could install, you know, more efficient scrubbers. They could switch to low sulfur coal, which doesn't pollute as much, or they could invest in things like energy efficiency and renewable energy as a way to reduce the air pollution coming from the electric power sector. And so that means, I think, you know, for electric consumers, that we're, you know, we'll hopefully see, you know, certainly get cleaner air, and we may also benefit from, you know, investments in new energy efficiency programs to help, you know, consumers and you know, buy more efficient appliances or weatherize their homes, things that both help consumers save money, but by, you know, reducing energy use, that means less pollution coming out of the smokestack.
Well, there are people who say this means more expensive energy, and this may mean actual shortage of energy if some of these coal-burning power plants, if it's not cost-effective to put in these cleaning apparatuses, then just shut them down.
Yeah, the you know, EPA calculates that the health benefits far outweigh the costs of compliance. So this is definitely a major net win for the economy and for consumers. And ERCOT, you know, just today announced that, you know, the projections for coming years, electric demand, you know, we should be fine. You know, there's several new, you know, natural gas plants that came onto line recently, so we'll be able to make sure that we're keeping the lights on, keeping the air conditioners running, while also having cleaner air.
Luke Metzger is the director for Environment Texas. We are slowly learning the facts concerning Tuesday's troubled execution in Oklahoma. Clayton Lockett was convicted and given the death penalty for the 1999 shooting of Stephanie Neiman, and then watching as two others buried her alive. According to the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, during the execution, a doctor could not find suitable veins in the arms or neck on Lockett to administer the death drugs, so they inserted the IV in his groin. and that vein soon collapsed, causing further complications. When Lockett showed signs of distress, pain, and straining to lift his head off the pillow, the prison warden ordered the execution halted. Then later, Lockett died from an apparent heart attack, 43 minutes after the execution began. Texas is planning its next execution on May 13th for Robert Campbell. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice released a statement saying it does not have any plans to change its execution protocol based upon the Oklahoma incident. However, because of the Oklahoma botched execution, there is growing pressure on states and the U.S. Supreme Court to ensure that executions are carried out properly and not in violation of the cruel and unusual punishment clause in the Constitution. Richard Dieter is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center.
Well, I think the state was unprepared for some of the eventualities. They were using a new drug, really a new protocol for them, and things did not go well. But beyond that, they didn't seem to have a backup plan. States have had trouble finding a vein, or the vein, you know, doesn't take the drugs that well. But there are cut-down procedures. There are alternative ways of, you know, finding a vein. And the last thing you want is to have to stop the execution and then the inmate die. So I don't know exactly what happened, but it started with apparently a failure of the drugs to really circulate through the inmate's body because of some problem at the access level, at the vein level. Apparently, there was a doctor who was there, but nevertheless, it all devolved with not an execution so much as a death resultant from the treatment he received.
It took 45 minutes for Clayton Lockett to die, have a heart attack after the beginning of the receiving the lethal injection. He gasped, he withered, he said, "Oh man," then he just, it was not what had been planned. By your considering the fact that there may be a mechanical problem with the actual delivery of the drugs, but are you concerned at all with this is a new batch chemicals being used to try to execute somebody? Could that be the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to wait and see what the investigation shows, but it could be both. It could be that because you're using a drug that maybe the volume has to be greater or the causticness of the chemical is different, that when you used to inject it, it worked fine. But with these new chemicals, the vein burst, and they didn't have a plan for finding another vein. To say that mistakes were made, I think, is clear. I mean, this was really malpractice. Incompetence in so many ways that I think it all has to be investigated. But I think the common thread is all states have to find a vein. All states are injecting chemicals. Some are injecting, you know, chemicals that are new to the process.
All states that continue with the death penalty?
No, all states use lethal injection.
Aren't there some states that have banned the death penalty?
Yes, that's true. Yes. Yes, there's 18 states that have banned the death penalty, at least going forward. Three other states in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado, the governors have stopped all executions. So there's quite a few states that aren't regularly carrying out executions, even beyond the ones I mentioned. All states have lethal injection, the federal government, the military, all have this potential problem.
But now the problem is, what are you going to put in their veins? We're seeing pressure on manufacturers of pharmaceuticals not to provide the drugs for lethal injections. And that's what caused the issue for Oklahoma, as they were searching for alternative pharmaceuticals to cleanly end the life of Clayton Lockett.
Yeah, they were grappling with using new drugs, which they were not revealing the source of. And so if there were some potential problems, no one out in the public was going to be able to say, don't do that. It's too much, you know, or too little, or the wrong drug, or be careful of the vein bursting. Because, you know, there was secrecy about all of this. No one could say to the doctor, you know, check for that vein before you put it in. You know, that it, so in a way what happened was a consequence of doing things in secret rather than, you know, being upfront from the beginning. Then there were mechanical problems. Then there were, you know, drug problems. We'll find out what it all was. But I think secrecy, which stems, of course, from what you said of drug companies, you know, not wanting to be part of the execution. So it's a web of things that have precipitated the present problems.
In the state of Texas, they have said they are going to continue with their scheduled executions. It's still a lethal injection, but they're using different chemicals or a different chemical to provide that. What oversight is there for states as they do this? Is it pretty much every state is on their own, and what works works and what doesn't, well, we'll try again something next time?
That is the formula they would like to have. I think, of course, in our system, you know, the courts are overseeing it. The public is overseeing it in the sense of, you know, when they find out that things went wrong, as they are with this Oklahoma case. This is, you know, this word got out. That's a check on the system, and I think that can be a healthy check even before an execution occurs, if information is out. Where did you get the drugs from? Well, you know, that pharmacy has had problems, that, you know, undiscovered, but we knew about them. I mean, let it be out there ahead of time so that when problems arise, you've considered them. And I think that's part of the check in a democratic system. The courts, you know, were willing to let these go in Oklahoma because well, there was pressure on them to do so, and they felt enough information had been given. But I think basic fairness requires more information to be given, and I think states would benefit, actually, from being more upfront than they have been and avoiding such disasters as happened in Oklahoma.
In Texas, they are not going to reveal where they received their lethal injection drugs from?
The Texas courts have yet to rule on that, I think, in a final way. They're allowing the executions to go forward, but my understanding is, you know, an initial ruling to turn the information over, and that has not been overturned. It's just that executions are not going to be held up while it's being decided. So there may still be a sort of a triumph for
but presently, we do not know.
Right. Yes, that's correct. We don't know, and the execution is scheduled, and unlikely, you know, that court's going to rule before then. But in the wake of Oklahoma, maybe courts will say, let's settle this issue because we don't want to even take a 1 in 100 chance of having, you know, an inmate die of a heart attack on the gurney after we closed the curtains and said it's not happening.
But so let me play this devil's advocate role here. As long as the convict ends up dead at the end of the process, how is that a botched execution?
Well, you know, here in this case, it wasn't even an execution. They had ceased the execution, so he died from malpractice by the state. It was a homicide, you know. But even putting that aside, let's say he did die from the execution process. We don't torture. We don't inflict intentional pain, or we don't carry things out with such negligence, such lack of preparation and carefulness that it of course results in gruesome pain. So some things are not allowed under our Eighth Amendment, and you know this certainly borders on those violations.
This would be cruel and unusual punishment.
Certainly, if it was any intention, it would be cruel and unusual. I think if it's an honest mistake, an unavoidable mistake, then no.
There's a mistake where there's no way you could have known, but there are mistakes where you should have known.
Exactly. I think that is going to be the dividing line, and the burden shifts after something like this happens to say, now you know what could happen. What are you doing to avoid it? Because you can no longer claim ignorance or, well, it worked well in the past. These are the kinds of problems that can happen. And that's why I mentioned in the beginning, what Texas does, what all the states do, physically is not that different from what Oklahoma was trying to do. And so the problem could occur elsewhere.
Now, let's get back to this issue of secrecy. When a state, a government, takes someone's life in an execution, that seems to be one of the greatest exercises of power that a state can actually do.
Yes.
And they do that in the name of everyone in that state. It is part of the process and the power of the government. Everyone here in Texas, everyone across the country, we're part of this. We join in that responsibility. Do the people not have a right to know where the drugs came from or what drugs are being used if this is being done in our name?
Yes, I definitely think they do. I think that that's not only a right, but it's the way systems work better. If we don't get to vote on everything every day, but we get to participate in democracy by having free speech, and that requires we know what the government is doing, where the money that we've gave them is going, who they're buying things from and negotiating with and using on our citizens. We may be very critical. People may even get embarrassed. That's the democratic. It works in the system of commerce. It works. It works in press and religion. We need information to exercise free speech. National security might be the exception, but executing people because a pharmacist might be embarrassed, I don't think is enough grounds for censorship or prior restraint on what's said about what the government is doing, which is where we're at. We can't criticize too much because we don't know.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Richard Dieter, the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, talking about recent developments in the death penalty after an Oklahoma inmate on Tuesday night was part of an execution, and it went horribly wrong for Clayton Lockett. So, Richard, y'all released a report this week looking at the possibility that there are innocent people on death row. What did you find?
Well, I have to say that we released a press release. It wasn't something we wrote. It was actually a report from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and so we issued a press release about that. And what it said was there's been a lot of innocent people freed from death row, but they are only part of the iceberg. There's more innocent people. We're not finding them, because they're often taken off of death row and at that point receive a whole lot less attention, legal review, judicial review and governors even, because they're just in prison, their exonerations are an afterthought. But if you're on death row and innocent, there's actually a high percentage. And if you do the calculations, if you're a statistician and can take one group and somehow mathematically put it in the other group, we find 4% of those sentenced to death are probably innocent. Our numbers from the Death Penalty Information Center, based on real cases, the numbers were about 1.6%. So we're missing a lot of cases, not that we would know where to find them. We rely on the courts, but the courts are missing these cases.
Richard Dieter is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Texas is planning its next execution on May 13th for Robert Campbell. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.